This is talking with Jules Ahrens at Ersi in Helsinki on August 78. Well, can you tell me where you, first of all, what your background is, and then when you first came in contact with radio astronomy? This is talking with Jules Ahrens on 7 August 78 at Ersi in Helsinki.
Oh, yeah, well, I can give you start at. I joined the Air Force Cambridge Research Center, as it was known, shortly after World War II, and worked in mostly in ionospheric and magnetic variations of the Earth's field. But then, I don't know if you know, Marcus O'Day put together the concept of instrumentation of Sac Peak. And the instrumentation of Sac Peak would be, in a sense, to supplement some observations of rocket firings.
Mm-hmm.
But he did, in a rather, I think, momentous occasion, O'Day and Menzel, and I was a junior person at the time, went down to Sac Peak in the late 40s and made the decision to. O'Day and Menzel did to set up Sac Peak as a solar observatory.
Now, what time are you talking about now? 53?
The end of 40s.
Oh, the end of the 40s, even that early.
Yes, and I have some photographs running around on the site at Sac Peak.
I see.
And as I said, at that time it would be a supplement to the sighting aspects. But the concept of setting up simultaneous radio astronomy observations of the sun also emerged, and they asked Professor Cornell University head.
Head of the EE department there?
Yeah.
Yes, I know who you mean.
Burroughs. Charlie Burroughs, if he'd be interested in setting up a system. And he did. He set up an operation, so at one time at Sac Peak, there was solar radio and optical observations.
I see. Operated by Cornell?
The radio was operated by Cornell and the optical by Harvey.
And when was this set up now, roughly?
This was, again, before 52. Mm-hmm. It then turned out to be a rather poor place to do any work, because there's too much radio interference, and working from a hill to do any kind of measurements in radio astronomy is a poor position. So I continued to monitor the contract with Cornell University on solar radio.
I see.
And my first paper on this came about as a proposal in the IRE proceedings in 54, emerged in 54, to use the sun as a means of calibrating radio antennas.
And also to use the sky for system temperatures.
There were a lot of errors and problems in it, but the concept was correct. And even today it's being used as calibration source by a host of antennas and radar systems throughout the world.
Well, you also were involved in trying to correlate the solar radio emission with ionospheric data quite a bit during this time.
Yeah, but then I went to, if you're interested in me, then I went to, in 53, 54, I took my doctorate in Paris in micropulsations and in second thesis topic was solar radio astronomy.
I see.
And there I met Steinberg and Denise and Bloom and Christensen was there.
Who was your advisor?
My advisor was Professor Bassi, but Denise was on the board of, on the group that examined me. And when I came back from the thesis, getting the doctorate there at 54, I started my own group at Air Force Cambridge Research Labs.
I see.
And this group had two programs. One was solar radio astronomy, and the second was ionospheric studies through the ionosphere. In other words, using radio star sources using cosmic noise background, right. Using later on satellites.
Which in fact has continued to the present. Yeah.
It's continued to the present, and that's primarily the work we do now is transionospheric studies. But we also have this global system of solar radio observatories, which is manned by Air Weather Service, but designed and developed by people in my group, notably John Costello.
When did that get started?
Now, in 1956, we first started on doing solar radio work in our group, in-house. And we did eclipse measurements, we did atmospheric measurements using the sun as a source, we did measurements involving gas and Cygnus, starting in 56. And as time went on, we did more and more solar work. And finally, in 1962, we made a decision to dedicate a program to continuous, what we called observatory-type measurements of the sun. In other words, we dedicate instruments, equipment, we monitor on a sunrise to sunset basis, many frequencies, and we also made a decision not to go the sweet frequency way.
I see.
Because the effects that I could see that had been proven, effects on the solar, on the Earth's atmosphere, were primarily from in the microwave region and the centimeter, well, from meter wavelengths to shorter wavelengths. So the sweep frequency equipment had a lot of excitement in determining coronal sources, etc., but not from the Air Force viewpoint.
Right. Well, you weren't interested in the astrophysics of the flares so much as the effect on the Earth.
Right. But of course, we had a dedicated group of about 10 people just on the solar program.
This is now the early 60s?
Yeah. And in 1966, the first solar, we finally went into what we call operational status. In other words, we assume we have to man it routinely, make calibrations, and keep the whole thing very consistent. Mm-hmm. And that's continued to present day.
Well, I noticed that in 1960, you had a report in the Astronomical Journal for the Sagamore Hill Radio Observatory. Was that the first time that you called it that? You were feeling yourself an official
maybe
observatory?
Maybe so. In 1958, we finally put our 84-foot antenna up there. And again, we did very special measurements, Cygnus and Cass tracking, Virgo. We did some solar work with it, not too much.
You did a lunar eclipse?
Yeah, we had eclipses that we did. We did temperature of the moon, mm-hmm. studies of this kind. But mostly in conjunction with either solar radio astronomy or the use of radio stars as sources mm-hmm. for studying the atmosphere.
Right. But what I was trying to get at, did you feel yourself part of the astronomical community at that stage to call yourself a radio observatory?
Well, as I keep saying, there are really two groups. The solar group is part of the astronomical program and always has been with IAU, and we haven't, Costelli had been a member of IAU and gone to meetings. And his, our emphasis as to where we go would be on these two aspects, the atmospheric effects and the, what we call the observatory type of long-term consistent measurements.
Right. Costelli, did he have a traditional astronomical background?
No, he came like almost all early radio astronomers from engineering.
Mm-hmm. But he still went to
John Hagen or Fred Haddock. Or
right. He still went to IAU meetings even in the 50s,
oh,
are you
sure?
Saying?
No, I think later on. But we, of course, maybe went to AAS meetings and things of this sort. And we did, as you noted, reports in observatory of what the progress is.
Right. Now, one paper that you gave at a National Electronics Conference struck me as interesting in 1960, Contributions of Radio Astronomy to Defense Instrumentation. And I was wondering if you'd just comment on this relationship between the military and radio astronomy in the U.S. Has that just been a reason to justify getting some money, or has it, have there been real contributions that the military can use?
Well, forgetting about that paper for the moment, the present time, the Air Weather Service, the military is devoting somewhere the order of 50 people to, 50 just for the radio astronomical observations.
But isn't this mainly to learn about the ionosphere and what's going to happen as far as communications?
You asked if the use of radio astronomy was a cover-up for research, or was it real use?
Okay, so
and it's a real use to the Air Force in that sense.
Yeah.
And I think in our study of the scintillation work, even before there were satellites, because we started this before there were satellites, and we'll continue when Sputnik 1 was traced, then it has been of use in those areas, as well as areas, some of which are still classified, but involving the lunar surface, involving sources of signals and calibration.
Navigation, right. But what about actually developing sensitive receivers and learning about large antennas? Has radio astronomy been a useful way to do that, or could that just as well be done by an applied
group? I don't really think so, because first of all, the primary requirement of a satellite tracking antenna is, for the most part, rather fast tracking, and also either programming or locking in beforehand. And so that's, but the people who developed the antennas, D.S. Kennedy and the rest, were involved in defense instrumentation at the same time. So I think in many cases, radio astronomy groups started use of big antennas, and then the DoD took over. As far as the receivers go, I think all those things are in the science of any time, technology. You get to the point where people are using masers or some sort of cooling systems to get low noise. Radio astronomy couldn't support that by itself, and so it's all in. Radio astronomy doesn't supply everything for DOD, and DOD doesn't supply everything for radio astronomy.
But now, I'm interested, though, why the situation developed in the U.S. and not in the other major centers, which are England and Australia primarily, or France.
Well, you have to look at it historically. The Navy, the ONR, was the primary supporter of radio astronomy earlier.
But why in the U.S.? Why didn't you get this military connection in other countries than you did in the U.S.?
Well, because I think it had to do with personalities as well. I don't know if you know what's the name of the guy who was feeding money in ONR.
Oh, yes, Shostak.
Yeah.
Yes.
Murray Shostak. Well, he really wanted to support very differently.
So in that sense, it was somewhat accidental.
Yeah, and then my group pushed too. We had solar programs with Cornell, with Coe, with Ohio State, and so on. So I think that the individuals involved pushed to some extent.
And perhaps the military had more money to give out for this sort of thing than they would in other countries, too.
And it was a startup, but it's not the way it is now.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, well.
That ends the interview with Jules Ahrens on 7 August 78.